Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Women's History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Jane Semeca, professor of history at Brookdale Community College. Today, we'll be discussing a new book by Leonard C. Spitali titled Victorine DuPont, The Force Behind the Family, published by University of Delaware Press. Leonard Spitali, welcome to the show.
Thank you for the invitation.
So what inspired you to write a biography of Victorine DuPont?
I can almost picture the day. My wife and I, we're from New England originally, and I had retired the year before. This was 09, and we were exploring the area. The Hagley Museum and Library is only 15 minutes from where we live, but we had never been there. So we said, well, let's go make a day of it. And first time we ever visited, it's beautiful. Have you ever visited that?
No, I've never been there. Well, now I have to go.
You do. It's on like 235 acres. You hear the name Hagley Museum and Library, and you think of a building. But this is where the actual DuPont company got started. It's the original site of the DuPont story. The family home is there, the rolling mills, outbuildings, the machine shop. And on the property is this Sunday school building that was built to be a Sunday school. And it was such an anomaly. Like, what is this doing on the grounds of an industrial mill workers site, you know? And they have interpreters there, what some people call docents, and they're volunteers. And they, so there was a guy there when my wife and I came to the Sunday school building, and he's telling about how it was actually the locus of education in that entire area. There were no schools, there were no churches. And this building was used to, any child that could get there on a Sunday morning would be taught how to read, spell, write, and learn the basics of Christianity. So it was really where children had a chance to become literate. Most of the mill workers' children had no access to schools, couldn't afford them if they had them. And so that was the story. Beautiful building, one room schoolhouse. There are replicas of the desks there and the tall walls. In the window well of one was a picture of a seated woman in a frame on black and white copy paper. You know, it really was just put up there. And so I asked who that person was. And he said, well, that was Victorine DuPont. He said, she was the oldest child of Eleuther Irénée DuPont and Sophie Madeleine DuPont. He's the father and the founder of the company and her mother. And she was widowed very shortly after her marriage, and she taught here at the Sunday school. And Jane, those were the 4 points. That's all he knew about her. And I came to find out later, that's all pretty much most people know, those 4 points. Her name, her position as the eldest child, that she was widowed early, and that she taught at the Sunday school. On that very day, but those 4 items were enough to stir my curiosity. So I went down to the gift shop afterwards thinking there was a book on her. No book. I went online, no biography, nothing. So I volunteered. He said, you know, they're looking for volunteers. And I said, you mean I could do what you're doing? He says, yeah, I'd love to have people here. Well, it was like the volunteer coordinator met me before we even left. And my wife is watching this whole thing with her mouth open. She's going, what? You're doing what? You know, we were just visiting and I wind up volunteering there. And that was the spark that got me going.
There are books about the DuPonts, but nothing ever that looked at her specifically.
No, in fact, most of the books have been about the men and the company. Very, very little about the women. And really, there's more to be found about the ladies in this family. Some wonderful stars are just waiting to be. I encourage anybody. And their correspondence is there, you know.
So talk a little bit about the research journey, right? So now you're inspired. You've seen this place that's right near your house that's so interesting, and that this woman has been overlooked, that she has no book written on her. So then how do you start writing a book about her?
Well, now that I'm a volunteer, and really, Jane, I had no, the idea of writing her biography was the furthest thing from my mind. I just wanted information that I could convey to the visitors, because you can go different ways in that building. You can talk about the workers, you can talk about the business, you can talk about early 19th century life in a mill workers community, or you can talk about the people, because it depends on the visitor's interest, you know. So I wanted to have information, and now that I'm a volunteer, I feel this onus to get what I'm saying correct, you know. And so I found out that the manuscript and archives had her letters there, and not just a few letters, but hundreds of letters, four pages long, because they use those tall pieces of paper and they folded them in half, and you get essentially four long pages of their letters. And so I was like, wow, this is great to actually be holding in your hands the interest of, you know, the person that you're interested in talking about. So that's how I got started.
Did you have to kind of transcribe them from the handwriting to, did you work with it that way?
Yeah, the staff at the manuscript and archives, in fact, and at the library, the two separate buildings, extremely helpful and friendly.
What would we do without the librarians? I mean, yeah, none of this would get done.
Yeah, I could tell a whole story there, but there were people there who, was one woman especially at the time. She's since passed away, Lynn Ann Catanese. She wrote the Women's History, a guide for the manuscripts at Hagley, what's there for about the women. So that book should be the first stop for anybody investigating what's there, how much is there. My biggest challenges in the research was there was no template for her life. You know, I didn't know anything about her. Fortunately, her letters are in chronological order. The challenge is that half of them roughly are undated, because they used letters just to send to the house next door. You know, it was their early form of texting, you know? And so there was a lot of letters, but thanks to the internet and the ability to not only search a time and a year, but to match a date, you know, with a day of the week. And so I had days of the week, and being able to follow the events, I was actually able to pinpoint dates and letters that had no dates, because I knew that it had to be the next day of a certain situation, you know. And,
oh, yeah, so that's great. That so you had to be a little bit of a detective, right? You kind of had to back into the chronology.
Yeah. And because I didn't know what I didn't know, I also didn't know what I didn't need. And so I took a picture of every single page so that I wasn't having to go to the archives every single day. I wound up taking a picture of every one of her letters. And there's four pages to each letter. But now that I had them at home, I could blow them up. especially places where, you know, they just scribbled and you needed the help. So I had them all at home. In a way, I had almost too much material, but because I didn't know what I would need, the first draft of the book actually was twice as long as it is today, because I had so much information. And I began to transcribe into print the salient points of every letter. It didn't matter what the topic was, whether it was plants or pets or people or poetry, things going on in history. I put them all in their categories and just said, so that I could do a search on that name to get that particular subject, because I didn't know what I needed.
You know? Right. And you have to find a way to organize it all, because there's so much. And in order for you to kind of even to not have to keep backtracking over the same letters over and over again, right? You had to come up with some system for yourself.
Exactly. Yeah.
I'm in the same boat.
Sometimes several systems. That's what gets hairy.
Yeah. So, you know, you write such a beautiful narrative, really, that weaves her story, her family's story, and the story of the world together.
Yeah, I have to fit that in. Yeah.
You know, so the DuPont family kind of provides the background for your book. So who, you know, just in case anybody's listening has never heard of the DuPonts, you know, can you tell a little bit about who they are?
Yeah, sure. As a matter of fact, when I finally submitted the manuscript to UD Press, I had to go through what they call peer reviewing. And I'm not an academic. I'm just a person who is very interested in writing and in this particular story. And so the peer review process was good. It was tedious and rigorous, but it made it a better book. But one of the things they commented on is I had the family starting in France, where the story begins. But one of the peer reviewers said, well, everybody knows that story. Just start with her story later. And having been an interpreter at the Sunday school, everybody doesn't know the story. And so I felt it really important that we start the story in France. And with especially with the grandfather, the DuPonts go back to the 1500s, the early 1500s. They can trace their family back to a man whom they don't know his given name, but they know that he had three sons. And from that beginning, the DuPonts trace their genealogy. So the family breaks into the three branches from those two. When it gets to Pierre Samuel in the middle of the 18th century, he's really the force behind the company. He was a, it's hard to describe him. He was a statesman. He was a philosopher. He was an economist. He was a
I think of him
teacher.
Too, like, you know, he's really a man of that era in French history, because so many of the great thinkers of France of the 18th century had talents in so many areas. I think of like somebody like Voltaire, you know, who knew math and philosophy and I love the way you connect her personality to his.
Yeah. Yeah. Intellectually, they're both prodigious. They're both, the grandfather thought Victorine was most like him when it came to intellectual curiosity. His name was Pierre Samuel. He was the son of a watchmaker named Samuel. He's the one who attaches de Nemours to the family name, because he was in the Constituent Assembly during the early days of the Revolution. And he did not favor the overthrow of the monarchy, but he thought it should become a constitutional monarchy. And because he was part of the Constituent Assembly, he thought that when the revolution was getting worse, he would be in no trouble. That all they tied him to was the monarchy, not the fact that he wanted a constitutional monarchy. And so he was branded as a loyalist and he was in prison. And I've got a line in there that if Robespierre had not first lost his head, Pierre Samuel would have lost his.
Right. Yeah, because it was dangerous, no matter what's, you know, depending on who happened to have taken control during the Reign of Terror or whatever, that these people were prominent enough to draw attention to themselves.
Yeah, and they were, anybody that was tied to the monarchy in any way was suspect. And Pierre Samuel had served in Louis XVI's court as his Minister of Commerce. He worked with Turgot. He knew everybody.
Yeah.
He was a friend of Voltaire. They wrote each other. And he embraced the Enlightenment with both hands. He was a product of it, and he was a contributor to it, I think. And so his family, the family was actually French Protestant background. They were Huguenots. There was a smattering of Roman Catholics here and there, as was Victorine's father's mother. He actually had to, when Pierre Samuel was going to marry his wife, the father was very Roman Catholic, and he insisted that the man not be a Protestant. But he asked Pierre Samuel that question, are you a Protestant? And by that time, he had renounced both Protestantism and Catholicism. So he answers, no, I'm not a Protestant. And so the father let him marry his daughter, assuming that he was a Roman Catholic. But in truth, he really had distanced himself, like many of the Enlightenment philosophers, from a biblical kind of faith.
And it really comes into the story, because it really is part of her spiritual journey, is connected to the family's beliefs and their origins the way through. So, yeah. So it's interesting. So how do they make their money?
Well, the grandfather was doing pretty well. He actually tutored a prince's son from another country. And he just had a lot of irons in the fire, but he loved to write. His writings are voluminous. He wrote an autobiography, started it while he was in prison. He wrote on commerce. He was part of a group of economists known as the Physiocrats, which included the elder Mirabeau, the Turgot, several of them. And they were really a little group, but very influential. There's a whole story there that got cut out of the book, but you have to taper it down to just how it affected the family. So anyways, he had connections, to make a long story short. And when the revolution heated up, he pulled out in the middle, was getting, he had to escape when it really turned into the violent part of the revolution. And it was heating up even more. The Reign of Terror began within a year after Victorine was born. Victorine was born in the middle of the revolution in Paris. But they moved her and the family to Pierre Samuel's estate in a town called Bois des Fossés, about 60 miles southeast of Paris. He had to escape there. They eventually arrest him there. Gets out of, during that time, before it got difficult, he had started a printing company in Paris. And that was really doing well. But when he had to escape, it was left to his son, Irénée. His name was Eleuther Irénée Dupont. He preferred to be called Irénée, so that's probably how I'll refer to him at that point. His name was, the father picked his name. Eleuther means freedom. And Irénée is the Greek word for peace. So you could see his father's influence in naming his son. And the other son was named Victor, after whom Victorine was named. But Eleuther winds up as a member of the National Guard, so he's not suspected by the revolutionaries as a problem. He's actually part of the National Guard at night, and he's working at the publishing company during the day. But anyways, when everything collapsed, Pierre comes back, realizes that it's getting the heat's up. And so the revolution really drives them from the country. Pierre, I don't think ever really wants, he loved Paris. He loved being in the thick of politics, but it was time to leave. And so he got some investors together. He knew several key people and said, I'm gonna start a company called The Father and His Sons in French. We're going to move to America, and we've got six or seven projects in mind. One was an export-import company. One was land development. He had a dream called Pontiana, where he could exercise his physiocratic principles. And he had really hoped to do that. But one by one, all those projects collapsed. But Irénée worked at the powder works under Antoine Lavoisier, the famous French chemist. And it was Lavoisier who was kind of mentoring him in this powder works trajectory. But when everything fell apart, Lavoisier loses his head during the revolution. And but Irénée now has all this gunpowder making or black powder making expertise. So he suggested it to the father that it'd be one of the projects. The father was very reluctant at first because he thought it was too risky financially. But they added project number 8 to the list. And in the end, to make a long story short, it was project number 8 that became the DuPont company that we know today.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah. So, you know, this, I love the way this book, you intersect with people like Lavoisier, and we're going to talk about, like, you know, the Marquis de Lafayette and all these fantastic people. And I love when biographies, you see all these famous people walk through the story, and it's so much fun to recognize them. So they wind up in Delaware. How do they wind up in Delaware?
Originally, and you being a New Jerseyan would appreciate this, they wound up settling in Bergen Point, which is right across the bay from, I guess, Manhattan. And a preliminary party had left France earlier to get things ready. The family, the bulk of the family leaves in the late fall of 1799. And so the lead family, part of the family, got a place at Bergen Point. Victor moves into New York City to establish the New York branch of the company and the headquarters. They're there for 2 years. Victor's business fails. He goes into out into the Genesee area of New York to start a general store out in which was the wilderness at that time. He doesn't do well at that, but we don't know that yet. So, but now really everything, all the chips essentially are now on the powder company. He meets, while he's there, he meets this man named Toussard, who was an artillery expert in France. And he too had fled, and he became part of Washington's army. A very instrumental in the New Jersey battles. But he loses his arm, I think, in one of the battles in New Jersey. But Toussard was familiar with powder making companies in the Pennsylvania, New York area. And he takes Irénée around to them. And Irénée just can't believe how primitive the American powder works are. They're working on plans that the Dutch used 50 years before then. And he just couldn't, he told his father, if we do black powder, we could really make a profit here because the Americans just do not have a handle on the way powder could be made. And so they moved to, he explores some sites down in the Federal City, Washington, DC area along the Potomac. He needed water and he knew that. And he decides to spend a day in Wilmington. And I put in the book that that day in Wilmington set the trajectory for the DuPonts for the next 200 years. He winds up meeting a man named Pierre Baudouis, who had anglicized his name to Peter Baudouis. And Peter Baudouis was a man of many talents. He was an architect. He could paint. He was part of the group that started the first waterworks in Wilmington. But anyways, he was very connected. And so he sees the potential in Irénée's proposal. And the two men at the very beginning really rely on each other. I've talked to some of the Baudouis descendants, and they experience a little frustration that their Baudouis' contributions were a little bit overshadowed by the ultimate fame of the DuPont company. But there's no denying that he was very instrumental in getting Irénée settled there.
You know, it's interesting too, like the you can see from your story that there was an entire community of French expatriates and French people who all supported each other, worked together, knew each other. And the school that Victorine goes to initially is the French school. So it's very interesting how it really talks a lot about how we don't know that much about American history and the French contribution to settling the in the early part of the Republic.
Jane, the French contribution was significant, especially because the people that fled during the Revolution were usually the professionals, doctors, scientists. They fled the country in droves because they were suspected to be tied to the monarchy.
Yeah.
Napoleon later recognizes what a loss they hemorrhaged their best people.
Yeah.
And he promised amnesty, and that proved to be true, to get them back.
Right. That was smart on his part. Yeah. So let's talk about Victorine.
All right.
So your title is that she's the force behind the family. So can you explain a little bit about how she is?
Yeah. In fact, the title by which I copyrighted it was The Influential Life of Victorine Dupont, originally. That's what, you know, when I finally was done, I realized this woman's influence was amazing, not only on her family, but on the entire community in which she lived in several ways, but primarily educationally, morally, spiritually, health-wise, socially, but on her family. It was French tradition that the oldest child would be the first tutor of their siblings. And in Victorine's case, she was the ideal person. She was the intellect of the family. She remained such. Even the grandfather acknowledged that she was the grammarian of the family, he called her. And she was insatiable in terms of her desire to learn, even as a young child. And so she was well suited by birth order. And by her historical position, she was the only sibling old enough to remember, have clear memories of France. And so she's also the one that really adopted the family motto, which Pierre called rectitudine sto, means upright I stand. And that was Victorine. She, doing the right thing was like a theme of her life. And so her influence, because especially on the American-born DuPonts, which four were born in France, one died only after 2 days, and four were born in America. So the age disparity presented this maternal aspect to her tutelage, because there was 24 years between her and the youngest son. And so it was significant in terms of the age disparity. And so her tutelage, and by this time, she had gone to school in Philadelphia, Madame Rivardi Seminary for Young Ladies, a very important school. That's a story in itself. But she became Madame Rivardi's top student and maintained that position for the remainder of the time that she was there. And at the school. So she was this unusual intellect within the family. So she provides the education not only for her siblings, but for her nieces, nephews, and cousins as well. So her impact was not so much to do with the company, but in the character of those who would later be leaders within the company. Even Alexis, who the youngest one, he was only 12 years old when their mother died. And so Victorine is 24 years older than he is. And on his deathbed, he was actually blown up in the mills. He died at the age of 41. But on his deathbed, he turned to her and said, "You have been a mother to me." And it's just kind of encapsulates the role she had in each of their lives. Even the older ones, Evelina was who was only 4 years removed from Victorine, was very dependent on her, had grown up that way. Alfred's 6 years. Alfred's going to be a leader of the family, but he's 6 years younger. But he she prepares Alfred for his early education in Mount Seminary, and also the son of Victor, Charles Arinet, is taught by her in preparation for going to school. So by the time Henry comes along and Alexis, they're boys. And so the influence that she brought to bear on their lives was very significant. And it carried throughout life. The book presents several instances where even as adults, Victorine's influence came to bear on their lives in various ways.
Yeah. So, you know, there's two really big turning points throughout the book of the story of her marriage and the story of her spiritual journey. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about those two big themes throughout her life.
That's a very good question, Jane, because it's a good observation because it was those two things that changed the trajectory of her life. With Ferdinand, they were childhood friends. You know, they grew up together on the Brandywine Creek. They watched Eleutherian Mills being built. You know, they would be clamoring through the hills as these young kids, 10 years old. And so they had this very unpretentious friendship, which by the time they're in their teens had evolved into more of a affection for each other. Victorine wouldn't have called it a romance at that point, but they were definitely heading in that direction. And if there was anybody in each of their lives that they were thinking of in a romantic way, it was each other. He winds up going to school in Baltimore, St. Mary's, with a good friend of his. And she winds up going to Madame Rivardi's, where Ferdinand's sisters are going. They were the ones who first alerted her to the school. And she was thrilled to be going there because Madame Rivardi taught her the things she wanted to be taught rather than just finishing skills, which is what she had learned in Wilmington under another French refugee named Madame Capron. But where her emphasis was on finishing skills, you know, music, embroidery, that did not interest Victorine that much. Victorine could play the piano, she could draw, she could dance, but she had this hunger for knowledge. And she really
loves science. She loves botany, she loves birds, she loves the natural world. Loves medicine. Like I kept thinking about these things being sort of tied together.
Yeah, they are. And that opens up another field we can talk about. But regarding Ferdinand, the long and short of it is they wind up getting married. He goes to France for 3 years. She doesn't commit to him. There's a kind of a romantic section there where he leaves, but he proposes to her before he leaves for France. And she turns him down because she's not ready. And there's a couple main reasons for that, but and she thought his proposal was premature. Unfortunately, it made his father think that she had been playing him for a fool all that time. And that did not help the relationship between the two fathers, which was already beginning to go south. But Ferdinand hears that she rejected another suitor of hers who was considerably older than she was, but she gave the other guy a firm no and made no promises to Ferdinand, but he knew that he was coming back in 2 years. It extended to 3 years, which really frustrated him. There's an interesting entanglement in France. He supposedly comes back engaged to one of his cousins. The story gets into that a little bit, but he's not back a month or two and he and Victorine are reunited. Victorine realizes she loves him, wants to marry him, and they're married shortly after he returns. He dies 2.5 months later of rheumatic fever, what they called at that time, inflammatory rheumatism. And there's a very descriptive, one of the friends of the Baudouis who was a very familiar with medicine, writes a letter describing his ailment to a T. So we have a lot of information there. Victorine goes into a spiral. There is some evidence that she was pregnant at the time that he died and miscarried. She's losing weight. She gets very depressed. But she had, in tying in her faith at this point, she had three friends from Madame Rivardi's who were very strong Christians. And it's through the influence, especially of the family of Rebecca Ralston. Her mother, Rebecca's mother, was a daughter of Matthew Clarkson, who had been a mayor of Philadelphia, noted for Christian faith. Her father is Robert Ralston, who has this very successful import-export business. So they're very well-to-do, but he's a very strong Christian. And out of his home, the Philadelphia Bible Society had started. Sarah starts four projects in the city geared towards helping women, indigenous women, indigent women, not indigenous, indigent women, Bible Society for women, and another for homeless and shelterless women. She also starts the first orphanage in the city of Philadelphia. So Victorine has a front row seat of all these projects that were really not women's domain at that time. It was Sarah's place in society that enabled her, without questions being asked, if she wants to go ahead and do it, she can do it. But it was all selfless. It was all towards the betterment of, there's a story that should be told of Sarah Ralston's.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
She has a great impact on Victorine because Victorine has a front row seat to Sarah's life because she was often in her home. And she's kind of became a role model to Victorine. During this time, Victorine is introduced to Christianity by these strong Christian friends and families. And for her, it's a long process of inquiry. You know, she's very intelligent, but she's been influenced by her father and grandfather towards a deistical kind of viewpoint. But it was being with Christians and observing their lives and seeing the reality of their faith that she's introduced to the Bible. And she begins to study the Bible. Of course, you know, it's
right. Like, yeah, she takes an intellectual approach to it.
Yes. And through that, she realizes the truth of the Christian gospel and gives her heart to Christ at a very early age. So by the time Ferdinand dies, she's still a very young Christian, but she has turned to her faith for consolation. And her friends keep appealing to her to become resigned to God's sovereignty, but his love and goodness. And that was a very important thing in 19th century. She's born during the middle of the second. She's in America at the peak of the Second Great Awakening. So the Christian influence has a strong bearing on the family, not the mother, not the father and the grandfather, but on Victorine. And it's Victorine who now is the tutor. And all of this is coinciding with the tutelage of the other siblings. So
her, and the death of her husband. So do you think this was also kind of offered her comfort that she needed?
Yeah, she was really incapacitated for the first, I'd say, 6 months. They even feared for her life. Her friend, you can tell by some of the letters from her friends that they fear that, not that she would take her life, but as I say in the book, that she wouldn't lift her hand in defense of it either. You know, yeah. She was just blown
despairing
away.
She was just in total despair.
And it was deep, and it was dark, very dark place, but her friends get her through it. She winds up going to Long Branch in August. I caught your enthusiasm for a New Jersey site.
Oh yeah, I love that. You know, like some good Long Branch story. You know, it was the place that people came for help. And if they were, you know, they believed going to the sea was healthy. And even the Grimke sisters, who were famous abolitionists at this time also, came, their father was ill and he came to Long Branch. And so they visited too. So Long Branch kind of, it's so fun to me that they, Monmouth County pops up in your story
I may
as a place for Victorine.
I may be wrong about this, but I think President Garfield was sent there after his assassination, hoping
absolutely he died there. Yeah, and Grant too. Grant took the when President Grant, when he was ill, sat on the porch of his house in Long Branch and wrote his memoirs. You know, when he was suffering. Wow. So it was looked at as like a health resort.
Yeah, and that was the Baudouis family and friends got her there for 2 weeks. She was very reluctant to go at first, but very grateful that she had went because it was a turning point in her recovery.
Victorine is such an important member of her community, you know, not just the family, but the entire community of the estate, the factory, the entire area. As a real, she finds herself as a leader of the school. And you think about all the lives she touched by teaching people how to read, teaching people appreciation for religion, and to be a visiting nurse to everyone.
Yeah, to the entire community. Because mill working communities was a tough life. A lot of them were scraping by. They depended on the mills for their livelihood. Victorine notes that many of the parents were ill-equipped to educate their children. They themselves had not received the education. They had a trade. They were hard workers, but they didn't have the wherewithal to really give their children an education, and the community had no schools. She did not start this school. It was started by a mill owner named John Seidel, but his mill gets wiped out in the flood of 1822, and he leaves the area. And the question now is, who's going to take over? Because it very well could have died at that point. He was the one who had gotten it started, and he was the one who superintended along with his nephew, James. James wasn't in a position to superintend it. And so who was going to give up their time for no pay, who had the intellectual capacity, compassion, and the ability to teach? It was only one person, and the whole community knew it. And so even the mill owners came to her, they actually came to approach her father first and asked if she would be willing. And so she's presented with this opportunity. And, you know, given her station in life, she did not have to give up all the work that would be entailed in superintending a school, which didn't just take place on a Sunday morning for the one preparing it. But she gives the next 45 years of her life to that endeavor, surrenders it. You know, here's this woman of high intellect teaching children the basics, and she does it for the remainder of her life. And the main reason is she loved them. And it was a place to serve. It was it gave the purpose and meaning of her life that, even though the trajectory of her life was changed by Ferdinand's death, she wound up the mother of many children.
Yes. And, you know, a sign of how respected she was and admired is how many generations and people in the family name their children Victorine in her honor.
Yeah, I had a whole list of them, but that wound up on the cutting room floor.
But it seems like a great many, you know. I didn't count them, but it seemed by the end of the book that there were a great many nieces, nephews, you know, all around the community who were named Victorine, and clearly as a sign of respect and admiration for her and what she had brought to their community. It's a very interesting theme in women's history in general, I think, as a women's history teacher, that how much women do for their communities, how much they don't, you know, they don't do it for their own aggrandizement or fame, but they do it as a sense of service to others. And it's a really, I think, an extremely admirable story to tell what she does for these people. I mean, it'd be interesting to know, this may have ended up in the edits of your book also, but how many people in the community who were taught by her go on to also give back and also to serve and have great lives because of what she gave them in terms of education and guidance and mentorship.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I tried my best to find some famous person that came out of it, but the impact, like the letters that I use at the end from many of the scholars who are now in the Civil War. She died on the eve of the Civil War. She receives many letters posthumously about the impact she had made on their lives. Many of the children, the words that come out about Victorine were that she was kind, gentle, and they remember the Sunday school as adults as the happiest moments of their life. They all, a theme seems to be in their letters that they just, even those that had good lives, look back at that as the happiest period of their life was the.
Oh, wow. That's really saying something. You know, and your book really is, it's really wonderful because it starts with the French Revolution, goes through the War of 1812, which we didn't even get to talk about. But I think that I love the story about her going to the White House, meeting Dolly Madison and going to Washington's fantastic. So the War of 1812 is in there, the Mexican War, and then ending with the on the eve of the Civil War. So we really see this woman's life, but also learn about the country during this really crucial period from the end of the Revolution, the early Republic, all the way to the beginning of the Civil War. It's really, you did a fantastic job in weaving those things seamlessly together.
Thank you.
So congratulations, Lenny, for telling this forgotten woman's story. It's really a wonderful book. And I want to thank Leonard Spitali for joining me on the show today. Thank you for sharing Victorine's story with us. I have been talking to Leonard C. Spitali about his new book, Victorine DuPont, The Force Behind the Family, published by University of Delaware Press. Until next time on New Books in Women's History, this is Jane Semeca. Keep reading.